You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. Tonight, we look back a half a century to the political turmoil of 1968. 1968 saw the Tet Offensive in Vietnam, the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., the cataclysm of the Democratic National Convention and the dividing of our nation, the election of Richard Nixon, who would become the only American president ever to resign the office of the presidency, and the end of the tumultuous presidency of Lyndon Johnson. Johnson became president on November 22, 1963, when President Kennedy was assassinated in Johnson's home state. Johnson was elected in his own right in a landslide election of 1964 and was expected to run again in 1968. My guest this week, Kyle Longley, has written a book that takes a close look at 1968 from the point of view of President Johnson. The book is called LBJ's 1968, Power, Politics, and the Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval. Kyle Longley, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
Our political climate today, as everyone knows, is deeply divided. One side has completely different alternative facts from the other. But it seems like the roots of those divisions can be found in 1968.
I think there's a lot of them that can be found in 1968. I try to make that point in the book time and time again. Whether it's looking at issues like dealing with the North Koreans, it's not something new. President Johnson had to do that in January of 1968, to Supreme Court nominees and the divisiveness of that as far as the president's appointments being turned down under the argument that, he was a lame duck president.
And so many things happened in that incredible year. It seems hard to even fit it in one book. But what was it about your book? There's been many books written about President Johnson and many books about 1968. So how did you approach your book?
Well, I think what it is, it's a biography of the president, looking at it specifically in that one year of 1968, a year he called a year of a continuous nightmare. And, you know, really zeroing in from the perspective of the most powerful man on earth and realizing, despite being the most powerful man on earth, there were so many things that he could not control.
And he was a guy who must have been pretty used to having things his way. I mean, he'd been in control of the Senate. I mean, I think he lost a lot of control when he became vice president, but in the early part of his presidency, he was very much in control.
Right. Well, and we do see a pivot in 1966 in terms of Congress. The Democrats that year lost 47 seats in the House. And, you know, there was a diminution of power by that point. But 1968 really put all his political skills to the test. And he was, I would argue, and I do make the argument in the book, a much more mature politician by the 1968, partly humbled by what he's had to deal with in terms of race riots and Vietnam and a number of other things, which just put it into perspective that he didn't have all the power that he thought he had.
How would you, before we get into the specifics of all the things that happened in 1968, how do you see him as a good guy or a bad guy?
I don't think you see him as either. I think you see him, and I think I'm genuinely pretty positive about how he handled the crises of 1968. But I'm also critical when necessary, how he handled the Democratic National Convention, how he handled the Supreme Court nomination of the 8th Fortas. There are areas where he did not perform as well, but generally I think if you gave him a report card, that year he did quite well.
Well, let's look at this incredible year, starting, I guess it begins with the Tet Offensive, right?
Well, I start the book with, you know, the State of the Union, just sort of set up what's been going on for the previous couple of years and what he's seeing and outlining for the year after. But I really think it starts with the Pueblo affair, where the North Koreans seize one of our intelligence ships in January of 1968 and hold 82 hostages for almost a whole year. And just shows the difficulties the president had in understanding why the North Koreans did what they did and then just trying to get the people back.
And how did he handle it as opposed to other hostage crises we've seen? First, was that the first hostage crisis?
Well, not necessarily. You know, you look at the longer history of, like, you know, take it back to Thomas Jefferson dealing with the Barbary pirates. But he did have, this was more of one of the ones of the modern era in which 82 American sailors are held hostage. And, you know, a lot of people are pressing him to do something more forceful, including acts of using nuclear weapons against the North Koreans. But his argument from the beginning is, if I do that, then I sacrifice the 82 hostages. And that's my ultimate goal, is getting there returned home. And he does by December of 1968.
And there's that great picture of the hostages all giving the finger to the...
Right. Which almost blew up the opportunities that he had taken advantage of to get them released. And when the North Koreans realize that's not a sign of friendship, that it almost ends the efforts to free them. But fortunately, the North Koreans by December have decided, well, we're going to move on to another thing of tweaking the United States. And unfortunately, that follows that following spring when they shoot down a spy plane during the Nixon administration.
Are there lessons that our current administration can learn from the Pueblo incident?
I argued in a Washington Post piece a few months ago in January that I do think there's lessons. One is patience. You have to, and then you also try to understand why they're doing what they are. And given that we don't even have formal diplomatic relations, we're handicapped there. So it's not putting in a perspective of what's going on globally. You have to look at it, what's going and why it's being done for the domestic consumption in North Korea. But again, in the ultimate long term, patience is the best virtue.
So then Tet.
And, you know, Tet is just a eye-opening experience for the American people. They've been told by Johnson and Westmoreland for the months preceding the Tet Offensive that, you know, it looks like we're turning a corner. And then all of a sudden, Tet happens, and, you know, you've got Viet Cong sappers inside the compound of the U.S. Embassy. They're hitting every major base in the country. And while it turns into a tactical victory, it does shake the confidence not only of the American people, but of the president and many around him.
So that leads me to how we got into Vietnam in the first place. I mean, I realize that we were involved in Vietnam before President Johnson, but President Johnson using the Tonkin Gulf incident definitely escalated the war, got us deeper in. And his motivations have been in question over the years. There's some who say, you know, he wanted to prove to Goldwater supporters that he wasn't soft on communism. Even Johnson showed reluctance to get involved in something he wasn't sure he could get out of. So how did it happen that we got in there in the first place?
Well, I think there's, you know, an interesting book that has been at the forefront recently is MacMaster's Dereliction of War. And it's one of the best studies of understanding how this sort of, you know, step by step, you know, event happened where we did become involved in this quagmire. And yeah, your point is well made. It existed before. John Kennedy likely would have done the exact same thing. I know some people argue that he wouldn't have and he would have done things differently, but looking at the 1964 election as well as the major problem being the South Vietnamese government not able to establish a foothold and maybe able to fight on their own led to the escalation, the U.S. having to put in additional forces, and that just escalated by until 1966. And Tet shows that at one point the military asked for another 206,000 troops, which would have put the number at over 750,000. And the question Johnson asked is this going to be enough to win? Is this going to bring us victory? And the answer is, we don't know.
So, you know, there's also an argument now that says, you know, we didn't commit fully to Vietnam, and if we had, we would have been victorious, and that would have been a good thing. What's your take on that?
Well, my take on that is, one, it's an ahistorical argument. They can make that assumption, but that there's no way to prove that. The second part, I always say there's two major things. One is, if the military couldn't assure that 750,000 American troops would be able to bring victory, then how many would it have been? How long would we have been there? And would it have weakened us? And I think this is the major point on a global scale. how might that have changed what happened in Western Europe? How might that have changed what happened in Korea or many other places? And I think the final part is Johnson was always looking at the issue of not wanting to start a World War III over Vietnam. And I think he was justified in that. And he's got the great quote. He says, you know, my greatest fear is a pilot from Johnson City, Texas, is going to drop a bomb down the smokestack of a trawler with the Soviet ambassador on it and thus igniting World War III.
So, again, are there lessons to be learned in terms of our current military situations?
Well, I think you look at it, and I think the lessons are still being echoed across, you know, what happened in Iraq, what's happened in Afghanistan. A wonderful book was written by George Herring called America's Longest War about the war in Vietnam. Unfortunately, he's going to have to change his title now because America's Longest War is now that has been fought in Afghanistan.
Right.
So I think there are a number of lessons, and the lessons that people tried to apply in Iraq were oftentimes taken out in Vietnam, but unfortunately they tended to be ones that didn't work on the level that they thought they were. And, I mean, you just saw John McCain admit after years of talking about victory in Iraq that it was a mistake.
One of the lessons, I think, from Vietnam that George W. Bush applied, which was not letting the media cover the war the way the Vietnam War had been covered.
Oh, that's definitely. And, you know, that is one of the people you were talking about, these people who make the argument we could have won the war if we'd only done A, B, C, or D. They like to blame the press. And in particular right now, I've seen a really upswing in blaming Walter Cronkite for going to Vietnam and after Tet and coming back and saying it's a stalemate. Only way we can do this is to negotiate from good faith and try to achieve, safe face. And a lot of people blame him for losing the war, but that is a grossly simplistic explanation.
He was just one reporter.
One. And, yes, he was influential. But we didn't. The war in Vietnam was not lost by the press. There were many issues that explain why the victory was achieved by the enemy, including their will, and combined with our difficulty of finding a client state that would be able to stand on its own. So there's many levels and far more complex than many of these people give the credit to.
Well, we think of President Nixon as being the first president to resign from office, the only president to resign from office, but when you read your book, Kyle Longley, LBJ's 1968, really LBJ resigned. I mean, he could have served another term easily.
Oh, easily. Well, I won't say easily. It would have been a fight. But, you know, many people argue, and I've heard this argument made recently, especially given the anniversary that occurs tomorrow, that Robert Kennedy ran him out of the race. And that's just wrong. That there's just nothing to support that assumption. If anything, that would have been the reason LBJ would have stayed in it. But he'd come to the conclusion, two things I think drove him out of the race. One was his health issues and his worry that he was going to end up like Woodrow Wilson, basically incapacitated in the second floor of the White House. And then second, his desire to try to find a way out of Vietnam and dedicating himself to the last 8 to 9 months of his presidency to trying to secure a peace that would allow the United States to extricate itself from Vietnam. So, you know, it is a resignation, but Harry Truman did the exact same thing. Almost 16 years to the date that Johnson announced his decision not to seek re-election on March 31st, 1968. Truman had done that 16 years earlier.
But, of course, Truman had served a much fuller first term.
He had. That is very true. But Johnson, you know, this decision, it is in his own mind the right decision to try to help. And by March 31st, 1968, he already has one son-in-law on the way to Vietnam and another one about to leave for Vietnam, and it becomes very personal. And the angst of Vietnam, and this is what I talk about in the book, is extremely important, that understanding Vietnam is still the Achilles heel that brings Johnson to that decision not to seek re-election. And I love the front cover of the book for that particular reason, because that's Chuck Robb's, he's listening to a tape from his son-in-law, Chuck Robb, who was a Marine lieutenant, talking about the loss of life in Vietnam, a loss of some of his men, and you can just see the devastation. You know, what it's wrecked upon Lyndon Johnson by this point. And then you also see in the background a bust of John Kennedy, and there's a great symbolism to that.
It really is a striking photograph of the president with his head down and his fist against his forehead. He's in agony, this guy.
Oh, he's definitely in agony. And, you know, his brother Sam talks about, you know, he couldn't go a day without really feeling the anguish of the people who were being lost in Vietnam. And I think this separates him sometimes from other presidents, that how personal he took the loss and how much of an effect that had on his life. And, you know, he didn't live much longer after he left office. Almost 4 years to the date that he left office, he has a massive coronary and dies in his ranch in Texas.
And he was relatively young when he died.
Yeah, just in his early 60s. And as I grow older, I realize that's not that old. You know, that's just one of the things. But, yeah, he died at a fairly early age, but he had a family history of that. And keep in mind, he had his first major coronary in 1955. He almost died from a heart attack in 1955. So those physical issues definitely weighed on his decision on March 31st.
When I was a kid in 1968, I thought the president was a really old guy.
Right, right. It's amazing how as we grow older, things all change in terms of perspective.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. We're talking today with Professor Kyle Longley. He's the author of LBJ's 1968, Power, Politics, and the Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval. My recollections of President Johnson when he was around, he was kind of a boring guy. That he, you know, when he spoke on camera, he had a kind of a monotone. But in the books that I've read, including yours, he really is a lively guy. Our current president has no filter. He just says what's on his mind, and he speaks in a very conversational way. But President Johnson was very careful about how he spoke in public.
Well, he was. But also, he's a master politician, and I don't think anyone can take away from his political skills. This is a man who rose up through the House, through the Senate, became the Senate, one of the youngest Senate majority leaders, and many would argue the most powerful ever. And he knew what he was, a political calculator to down to the nth degree. And but boy, behind the scenes, and this is what part of why I've been attracted to this topic was, he gives you such good copy. He gives you so many great stories to sort of develop. He can be crass, he can be vulgar, but he also can show this other side that I think this book highlights, that some of the other books don't do as well, that he could be sensitive, that he could be concerned. And we see that, for example, in how he deals with the death of Bobby Kennedy, his arch nemesis. But he shows genuine compassion towards the family and towards the loss.
Well, talk a little bit more about, before we get to Bobby Kennedy, which is very interesting, but I want to know a little bit more about the resignation speech, or his decision not to run again. How did that speech come about, and how did his family react and the people around him?
Yeah, I think between you and I, there's several chapters that I love in this book. I mean, you like all of them, but there's certain ones that you just really pull toward. And that March 31st speech and the discussion of how he had this already in mind for his State of the Union address in January, but at the last moment he pulled that part of the speech. But it really was the family being torn, Lady Bird especially, you know, ambivalent about the decision, but happy once it was done. But again, you go back and look at the reasons why. They all understood that he was under great stress. They all worried about him. And, you know, he worried about himself in terms of the physical health. But and again, Vietnam just keeps coming to the front and the center, and Vietnam is just hanging over the country. And when he does make the decision, people genuinely support it. He flips his popularity rating overnight and receives a lot of warm welcome or well wishes from across the political spectrum for making the decision to sacrifice what some characterize sacrificing his political career to pursue peace in Vietnam.
So then, of course, he created a vacuum that meant there would be a tussle for the Democratic nomination for president. And we know that the end result was Richard Nixon, which there wasn't a Democrat in America that wanted that to happen. Did people blame President Johnson?
I don't think they blame him. I think they look at, I think, well, let me take that back. I think some groups do blame him. You know, of course, the Democrats get stuck with the Vietnam War and the label and how it divides the party, and we see this play out especially at Chicago in August of 1968, where there are fights on the floor, literal fights, fist fights and fisticuffs and shoving, and just how it has divided the Democratic Party and then allows Nixon to come in. But also, you know, people are looking and going, why is the country falling apart? What explains it? And you got Nixon on the other side promising law and order and then a peace with honor in Vietnam. Of course, it's a secret peace that he can't give any details for, and we know how that works out. But, yeah, I think there are some that blame, especially the Kennedy loyalists, that blame him for what has happened to the country and what has happened to the party. And I do, to a degree in the book, highlight, you know, the damage that he did to Hubert Humphrey as a result of his preoccupation with Vietnam and also trying to control the Democratic Party through the primary process up to Chicago.
And one of the subtexts that's in your book and that you just kind of hinted at is that protest, which was a huge part of America in 1968, you know, nothing, you know, there's nothing that can compare to it. The kind of protests that go on today are very small in comparison. And yet, both after Martin Luther King's death and 1968 Democratic Convention, the protests in some ways do damage to the cause of the protesters. I'm thinking of when President Johnson tried to pass his Housing Act and people looked at the black riots after Martin Luther King's death as good reason not to have such an act.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, you're going to see the backlash created by the riots. But the riots had already started, you know, the summer of 1967 had already set sort of the tone. And, of course, Watts in 1965. And it's leading to a backlash that we see first in the midterms in 1966 and definitely see in the election of 1968, where Nixon uses that law and order. And, of course, the subtext of that always is race. And I have a quote in there about Strom Thurmond as soon as Martin Luther King is assassinating, saying something in the order of, well, this is what you get when you give these people too much power or too much hope, and saying, you know, it was better back when we kept them in their position. And that Strom Thurmond, who now is a Republican and started the whole process in 1948 with the Dixiecrat Party. So, yeah, it is hurting their own cause in many ways. But, you know, Johnson, what I really think after the Martin Luther King does quite well is he shows some empathy, and he does understand why these people are angry and why they're rioting. Of course, he's calling for peace and calm, but at the same time, he shows, there's a quote in the book about, you know, I get it. When you see your leaders being shot, cut down, you're going to think you're next and why you're going to be angry. And, you know, he does use the King assassination to push through the Fair Housing Act of 1968 with, you know, trying to make lemonade out of lemons. But he definitely sees that. But a lot of the American people, especially the white working class, the backlash is so significant. And we're going to see that play out even into today.
Yes, even into today, which is amazing.
Yeah.
50 years later, some of these same issues that you write about in LBJ's 1968 just keep coming back.
Oh, yeah. And that's what I think makes the book even that more resonate, why it's important to understand this period, is that the issues, I argue, and I hear this often, that, you know, Donald Trump is trying to undo, you know, the policies of Obama. Well, no, in many ways, what the Republicans and Donald Trump are doing, they're trying to undo the Great Society, Medicare, environmental changes. I mean, I can go across the board, federal role in education. It's just all there. And you want to understand the roots of it, you go back to 1968, you go back to the 1960s, and especially 1968 for the backlash.
Or even 1933. I mean,
President
Johnson's idol was FDR, yeah?
Definitely. Social Security's next on the hit list. You know, but you really look at this first, you know, the lessons. And again, I use the Supreme Court nomination issue of the first time they really roll out the idea of, well, lame duck president should be able to make the choice. And we're going to see that resonate very quickly today.
That's right. So talk a little bit about that. Who did he try to appoint, and what happened?
Right. Well, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court announced he was not going to retire until Johnson had filled the position. This starts in June of 1968. And so Johnson decides to promote Abe Fortas, who he had put on the court in 1965, to the Chief Justice position, and to fill his position with one of his political underlings from Texas, a guy named Homer Thornberry. Well, immediately the Republicans organize against this, and the guy that leads it is Robert Griffin, a senator from Michigan, and his argument is the president should not be able to make that decision because the next president should be able to do so. So that's one of the tacks that they run with. Of course, they're going to go after the Warren Court, saying that Fortas is just a symbol of the liberalism, that he supports pornography, he supports opposition to school prayer. I mean, the whole cultural issues that we still see playing out today, and they're going to try to tar and feather him. And, of course, Fortas in some ways gives him a lot of ammunition because of his questionable activities. Ultimately, by 1969, are going to lead to his dismissal from the Supreme Court. So it's this long, drawn-out battle over the summer, and Johnson's people try to push it through, but ultimately run into the opposition of the Republican Party and ultimately are betrayed by the Southern Democrats, who just will not support this guy because he had actually been an advocate for civil rights. So ultimately, Fortas is defeated in the position, and by 1969, it's going to be Richard Nixon who gets to do the ultimate appointments. And he's going to run into his own problems with Carswell and Haynesworth. So it starts these battles over the Supreme Court that we see play out today that really did not exist at the same period, in the same way before 1960.
Although, again, FDR had his problems with the courts.
Oh, yeah, he tries to pack it. And, you know, I make the point that Johnson, in his own way, contributed to the defeat. He and Fortas were too close. Fortas was advising him while he was sitting on the Supreme Court. There was definitely some challenges there, but yeah, the court packing scheme, but you never seen to the degree a Supreme Court nominee, this had almost been pro forma throughout most of the history. You could count the number of people who had been turned down on one hand, but boy, they made it very much a political issue. And again, all we got to do is look in the last couple of years to see that play out again today.
Yes, and of course, in recent history, you know, ever since, I guess, Robert Bork, every
right.
Supreme Court appointment is much more closely followed than it used to be.
Oh, much more so. But it starts with Fortas, and it starts with this.
If he had not announced that he wasn't running again, then things would have been different, right?
I think so. Although I still think there would have been opposition by the Southern Democrats and the anti-Semitic elements of society to Fortas. But I think it would have gone through without the, you know, long hearings that are taking place. Fortas actually has to go in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, and it sets off a firestorm. And a lot of the things that ultimately are going to bring Fortas down probably would not have come to light had it not been for Johnson announcing his March 31st decision.
We're talking with Kyle Longley, and his new book is called LBJ's 1968, Power, Politics, and the Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval. Talk a little bit about the relationship between President Johnson and Robert Kennedy. When Johnson came to office, Robert Kennedy was the Attorney General.
Right. They hated each other. I mean, I have to look hard to find political rivalries that have been so nasty and so bitter in American history. You know, you have to almost go back to Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr to find some of these, especially within their own party. But Robert Kennedy really started it in 1960 when he opposed Lyndon Johnson's efforts to get into, to become on the Kennedy ticket. And it just spiraled from that point forward. The Kennedys looked down on the Johnson, more Bobby than Jack, and it just created tensions that were highlighted throughout their careers, and it's just bitter. I mean, you're hard-pressed to find a political rivalry like this one. And, you know, it leads when he's attorney general, then he leaves, becomes senator from New York, and there is this constant tension, and it is just bitter across the board.
So given that, you might think that Johnson might rejoice when Robert Kennedy was murdered.
Right. You would think so, but it wasn't. And that's where I think I actually have a piece coming out in the Washington Post tomorrow talking about that. And I think the chapter highlights that from the book, that no, he saw this as a great tragedy. Even though it's his bitter rivalry, arch nemesis, he didn't treat it like that. He tried to treat the family with the greatest of respect. First thing he did was he took the children and put them on a government plane and flew them to California to the hospital. When he died, he helped make sure all the arrangements were made to have Bobby placed in Arlington near Jack. And, you know, you don't seem to show emotion often, but there's that scene in the back of the limo when they're burying him in Arlington, and he is shedding tears because just looking at the life of Rose Kennedy and the loss of her sons and the, you know, the great challenges that she's faced, this is not a side of Johnson that you often see. But definitely this assassination brought that out, and it showed his compassion and his empathy that could exist. It shows a much more complicated figure than oftentimes caricatures are made of him.
What do you, you know, just conjecture, what do you think about President Johnson's private thoughts on the matter?
Well, I think, again, he's looking at this as just sort of a long, you know, a litany of the what's going on that year. And, you know, he genuinely, in many ways, liked Jack. They had a complex relationship, but there was not the animosity that existed between him and Bobby. And I just think that, you know, privately he's just looking and going, he's feeling bad for the family, but he's also feeling bad for the country. And just seeing the rug be pulled out from under it, and, you know, he still loves his country. He still loves the office of the presidency, and he just sees that this is just further dividing the country, and that is not a good thing in his eyes.
I'm Gary Shapiro. You're listening to From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking with Kyle Longley. His new book is LBJ's 1968, Power, Politics, and the Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval. There's a current kind of trend in history to look at Hubert Humphrey as kind of a sad victim of 1968 also.
Oh, definitely so. And I do, you know, I think I present a very, you know, I have actually had people in the Johnson group tell me I'm too hard on him and his relationship with Hubert Humphrey. But, you know, Hubert Humphrey was a loyal soldier, and Johnson did not treat him as well as he should have. And I think there was, you know, a cultural divide that existed between this, you know, liberal from Minnesota and this good old populist from Texas. In terms of how they saw, you know, what the role of a man should be in manhood, and there's a clash there. But I think Johnson could have done a lot more to help Hubert Humphrey win in 1968, and he undermined him, especially in Chicago, on a number of things. And, you know, that one I'm very critical of the president and how he treated that particular person.
Do you think President Johnson was secretly hoping that there would be a massive call for him to be president again?
Oh, of course. This was a man with a huge ego. And, you know, he surrendered the presidency, but and the argument is made by people closest to him. He wanted to at least be asked to come in to be the savior of the Democratic Party. And he's holding on hope. And I think one of the saddest scenes in the book is when he's at the ranch on his 60th birthday, on the day before Hubert Humphrey is nominated, and he's hoping the convention's going to call him to come to Chicago to be honored and maybe be honored in asking him to step up to lead the party, which many argue that he would not have accepted, but he would have loved to have been asked. And that call never came. And you see him on that birthday, by 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock in that afternoon of his birthday, it's hitting, and he's just, you know, it's sad in so many ways to see this man that is set at the pinnacle of power now reduced to this, you know, celebrating his birthday just with the close family because his hope had been he was going to be exalted in Chicago, and the call never came and the plane ride never occurred.
Well, how did Hubert Humphrey feel about President Johnson?
Well, I think he genuinely respected the president. He was one of the most loyal soldiers in the you know, among the confidants of the president, and he wished he would have been treated better. And I think, you know, for example, in the Chicago Convention, he wanted to hold it in Miami, make it harder for all those protesters to get to the location, because he understood what some of the challenges were. He fashioned a Vietnam compromise plank that could have reduced much of the tension between the anti-war groups and the people who had supported the president, but the president undermined him. And so, you know, it's a complex relationship, but genuinely I think they liked each other on a basic level and respected each other on a basic level. It just sometimes, you know, they were just overcome by the differences in their own personalities.
Looking back in history, there were a lot of candidates for president, like William Jennings Bryan or Adlai Stevenson, who ran multiple times. It wasn't like they were branded a loser and they could never come back. Whereas today, you know, that could never happen. I mean, once Dukakis lost, nobody would ever think, let's nominate Dukakis again, or Kerry, or Al Gore. Al Gore had, you know, what got more votes than any other president. Even though he wasn't president, he got more votes than any president in history before him.
Right.
What's changed?
Well, I think that, you know, I would disagree to a small, you know, it comes out of, yeah, the presidential race, definitely so. But, you know, really, you don't see it. Richard Nixon is the exception, the rule, in many ways. A guy that is defeated in 1960, but then comes back in 1968. You don't see that happen very often in U.S. history. Now, they may have lost in the primaries like Ronald Reagan did in 1976, and then come back in 1980, or Hillary Clinton in 2008, and then comes back and runs in 2016. But, you know, once you lose that big one, but your point is well made, Adlai Stevenson being an example, William Jennings Bryan. I mean, the Democrats nominated Bryan four times, and he lost four times. Maybe they were smarter today. You know, people figure it out. You lose one time. You know, you had your shot, barring that there were some unforeseen circumstances. You don't get a second chance because Stevenson, he lost twice. So, you know, maybe that's an explanation.
What about Nixon? How did President Johnson feel about Nixon personally?
You know, there's a strong strain between them. He did not like Nixon, and that goes back to the days of Nixon skewering close confidants of the president in 1952, especially with how he ran the Senate race against Helen Gagan Douglas. And so there's a long-standing animosity. He did not like him when he was Senate Majority Leader. The only thing that really, I think there is some affinity there because they come from similar backgrounds. Boy, they're rough. You know, they came from tougher backgrounds. They had to overcome a lot to rise to the pinnacle that they did. And Nixon's support on Vietnam always sort of flattered Johnson. But there is no love lost, and I think you see that play out very strongly in the Chenault affair.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is where the Nixon campaign was actively working to undermine the peace process with the South Vietnamese government, working through a woman named Anna Chenault, as well as other channels that they were using, arguing to the South Vietnamese government, we'll give you a better deal, because their great fear was they saw those numbers changing in the last moments of the election, and Johnson announces a bombing halt in late October with the idea that the South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese and the United States are going to continue and build off of what they've been doing in Paris since May of 1968, and it's going to lead to a great breakthrough, which is going to put Humphrey over the top. And the Nixon people went out of their way to try to undermine that process. How deeply Nixon was involved in the process, we don't have the smoking gun, but we do know the Nixon campaign was actively working with the foreign government to undermine the process that ultimately did collapse and would not be really reborn until, you know, and finalized until 1973.
And we know that Nixon was dirty tricks and all that.
Oh, definitely so. I mean, there was no doubt about that. I wrote a biography of Senator Albert Gore Sr., Al Gore's father, and the Nixon people in 1970 illegally funneled about $300,000 into the campaign of his opponent, which in 1970 was a lot of money. And we know that all this is going on, and the Chenault affair is resonating again today. What role did the campaign of one of the people play in working with the foreign government to try to influence the election. Again, another one that is playing out very strongly today.
It's fake news, Kyle Longley.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, I know. That's what we hear. The great thing in this is we had the file of the FBI wiretapping the South Vietnamese embassy, as well as Madame Chenault and also the presidential palace in Saigon, with the information flowing back and forth and being provided by the FBI to the president. But the president hesitates for two reasons. One is he's afraid the damage it will do if Nixon wins and you start a constitutional crisis immediately. And second, he would have to give up the informants and how he obtained the information. And this will stay basically buried until the early 1990s.
One of the great things about our country is that we have an inauguration. We don't have a king. Our presidents step down and peacefully transfer power to the next leader. Although I think it can often be painful, as we've seen recent years. So how was it for President Johnson?
Well, I think there's a genuine feeling of relief that he is now able to remove this burden off his shoulders. It had been a tough few years. I mean, when your daughter is telling you about listening outside her window as people chant, "Hey, hey, LBJ, how many children did you kill today?" That any place he went, he was met by protesters. And now he can just retire to his farm or to his ranch in Texas and become an average guy again. Again, that's not going to last very long because he's going to die in a very short period of time, just within a few years. But there is a relief, but there's also that concern. You know, what's next? And he does not trust Nixon. And I think if he'd lived past 1973, he would have probably said one of his greatest regrets was not letting the information on Chenault and the Nixon campaign's role in the peace process out to try to shape the ultimate outcome, because ultimately Watergate became much worse than anything he would have anticipated as a result of Chenault. So I think that, you know, he's relieved, but at the same time concerned.
I love that he let his hair grow out.
Yeah. Well, you know, I love that last scene where I talk about when he goes to the Civil Rights Conference in 1972 in Austin, drives across ice roads, and when he gets there, he starts his speech, and the first thing he does is he takes out a nitroglycerin pill and puts it under his tongue. If you watch that speech, you see a man that is very different from what we see as far as things that are portrayed when he was in the 1964, you know, things that we've seen, like in All the Way, you know, the Schenken movie with Bryan Cranston and the new one with Rob Reiner and Woody Harrelson, strong, vibrant. You compare and contrast that to where he is in 1972, and he dies less than 6 weeks later. Yeah, his hair is longer. He's a frail man. He's having a lot of problems. And again, he dies of a heart attack in January of 1973.
What, if anything, was President Johnson's take on the popular culture of 1968, which was such an important part of our lives?
Well, you know, he really didn't talk about that much. Of course, he had his views of the anti-war protesters. He had his views of those senators who opposed him. He called Senator Fulbright Senator Halfbright. You know, he definitely had a view on that, but he was just concerned with the general direction of the country, because there's very few times in American history that we see this transformational period occurring, and 1968 is transformational. And, you know, you're seeing major changes that, again, we're still fighting today about, you know, what is the role of religion in government? What is the role of, the secular society, debates over pornography, debates over guns, which I talk about in the book after the assassination of Robert Kennedy. They're all here. They're all still playing out. And so much, for all that has changed, it hasn't really changed that much.
This book is called LBJ's 1968, Power, Politics, and Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval, and the author, my guest, Kyle Longley. Professor Longley, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Oh, thank you very much for the opportunity.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program. I want to thank my guest, Kyle Longley, author of LBJ's 1968, Power, Politics, and the Presidency in America's Year of Upheaval. Be sure to check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. From the Bookshelf is produced by Francis Venegas and Ollie Jackson. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.